Hi, it's Radhika Jones, Editor-in-Chief of Vanity Fair. As we gear up for award season, there's no better time to join us. By becoming a Vanity Fair subscriber, you'll gain exclusive access to our in-depth coverage of film, television, and the best of Hollywood. And that's just the beginning. Vanity Fair takes you inside the worlds of entertainment, culture, politics, and scandal, bringing you iconic images, era-defining stories, and much more. Get 15% off a year of digital access to Vanity Fair by visiting vanityfair.com and using promo code POD15 at checkout. That's vanityfair.com, promo code POD15, for 15% off a full year of insights and exclusive digital access. Subscribe now.
And welcome to Little Gold Men, the award season podcast from Vanity Fair and Panoply. I'm Katie Rich, the deputy editor of VanityFair.com, and I'm here with Vanity Fair's digital director, Mike Hogan.
Hey, Katie.
And Vanity Fair's film critic, Richard Lawson.
Hello.
And Vanity Fair senior writer, Joanna Robinson.
Hi, Katie.
We are coming to you in what I think we keep calling the dead week. It's the week between Christmas and New Year's when, as far as I have heard, all Hollywood is just on vacation. So good for them. Enjoy Hawaii. And some of the rest of us are, you know, spending time with our families, catching up on screeners. So we're going to use this time to kind of look at the year as a whole. Richard has published a top 10 on VanityFair.com, and we have all been kind of writing and discussing various of our favorites of the year. So we're going to start by talking about Richard's top 10, then kind of get into some of our own personal picks, which is going to include both film and television. Since, you know, the line gets blurrier and blurrier as things go on. But Richard, yeah, to start, let's just go through your top 10 list, because I think we've seen a lot of these films. I think that's a pretty good start of saying what the best of the year was. Sure. Your number 10 is The Lobster.
Yeah, a movie that I saw in May of 2015.
Yeah, and so timely.
It's on the 2016 list, just because that's how film festivals work and everything. Yeah, what a great movie. What a weird, sad, wonderful kind of sci-fi sort of thing. Great performance from Colin Farrell. Great performance from Olivia Colman, who has had a great couple years.
Yeah.
John C. Reilly, Ben Whishaw, Lea Seydoux.
Rachel Weisz.
Ariane LaBed. Like a bunch of just really great people. And I don't know. That movie, you know, I saw it a year and a half ago at this point for the first time. And it just really stuck with me. So I felt like I had to put it on the list.
Well, you're not the only person that stuck with it. Got Colin Farrell a Golden Globe nomination,
right.
Which was such like a weird, like, you know, the Hollywood Foreign Press giveth and taketh away. Like it gives you really bizarre nominations you don't want and then gives you bizarre ones that you do want. Like,
yeah, but that's where, you know, sometimes the kind of split between comedy and drama, the Golden Globes can wreak havoc. Mm-hmm. But in other cases, it can allow for someone like Colin Farrell to be nominated, you know.
And well, it's a side-splittingly funny performance.
Well, exactly. You know? Yeah, it's a real laugh riot.
Yeah,
this
yeah.
Bleak movie about how if you're single the world is gonna end. You know, Colin Farrell actually was a Golden Globe winner for In Bruges.
Indeed.
A wonderful performance.
That for that alone, yeah. The HFPA is like deserves eternal credit.
Yeah.
This movie is so much fun and yet
when
like incredibly
in
dark
quotes.
And disturbing. It's this like vicious little thing.
Yeah. It's hard to say if its worldview is like being single is the worst or being in a relationship is the worst. Like it's kind of hard on both.
It's sort of multi-dystopian viewpoint.
Yeah.
And it's one of several ambiguous or down endings of the year. It seems to be like quite the trend, even in your Star Wars. But it kind of started with The Lobster where the credits roll and someone in my audience was like, "What?" What?
I think someone in my audience did that too. It's like, you're just going to leave it there? And I was like, yeah, they are.
I love those endings. That might be what's wrong with me in general. That's going to come up again.
Yeah, we'll get into that. Okay. Richard, your number 9 is Mountains Made Apart by a director who, if you can pronounce his name, I'll be very impressed.
I believe it's Chia Zhangke, but I don't, I mean, that's just me kind of stabbing at it. But
no native Chinese speakers on this podcast, unfortunately.
Also a movie I saw in 2015.
Yeah.
At Cannes. It's this really... this guy is this allotted kind of international world cinema director. He's made a lot of movies that have been better reviewed than Mountains Made Apart, but this was my first experience of him, and I actually kind of went back and watched a couple of his other movies, and they're great. But this is this really interesting story that's very timely. Even though it takes place at some point in the past, it's kind of a triptych, like Moonlight is. It's about young, kind of, you know, 20s, early 20-something Chinese people right in the late 90s, kind of when China was starting to sort of peer up and out of itself and into the broader world and, you know, experience the economy. And then the second part takes place a few years later when, you know, that has sort of solidified as a reality. And then the third part takes place in the future, actually. And it's this generational story. It's really beautiful. It's really sad. But it offers this amazing window into contemporary Chinese life for kind of what their version of the middle class or the upwardly mobile is. And, you know, it's a rare film that I think has a lot of critique for the Chinese sort of social system and economic system, but that also has the blessing of the Chinese government, which is really rare. Mm-hmm. So if you're looking for a movie that sort of, it doesn't explain it in any sort of, you know, academic terms, but in an emotional sort of sociological sense, like, I feel like I learned a lot about what kind of contemporary Chinese life is like. You know, we tend to think about that country as sort of this monolith of just like an ideology that's opposite to ours, but it shows humanity. So I put it on the list.
Is now more than ever the time to get to know China before we start a trade war with them?
Well, Jesus. I mean, yeah, like, we got to try something, right? You know,
I know you guys are expecting me to say, I'd love to see that movie, but I haven't.
But you have?
But it's even worse than that. I tried watching it on a plane and I turned it off after a half hour.
Oh, no, not a plane movie. Not a plane movie.
But yeah. Someday I'll come back and watch it.
I mean, I think the best context to see that movie is when you're in the south of France.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll get there.
This is one of those like 9 a.m. film festival movies. Bring a large coffee.
Yeah. And, where I was kind of
experience
raw.
Experience the world.
Yeah. Yeah. The movie uses a motif in the beginning and end. I don't think this is a spoiler. That features the Pet Shop Boys song Go West.
Yes.
And it's heartbreaking. And you never would think of this song as this like poignant sort of, but it's really great. I mean, it's worth seeing for that alone.
Is it eligible for a foreign language Oscar?
I think it is, but I think it's not in the, okay, it didn't make the short list.
It is not on the short list, yeah. My version of your story is that I paid to rent it on iTunes, didn't watch it before it ran out, and it went away, and now it's on Netflix for free. So
well, there you go.
Serves me right. Okay, number 8. I don't know if we talked about this movie yet at all, and I still haven't seen it, but Edge of 17, fall release that isn't in the Oscar hunt, but I just keep hearing people like you, Richard, say that it's one of the best of the year.
Yeah, I was really excited when we voted for the New York Film Critics Circle Awards. It and Krisha tied for best first feature, and I think that Krisha, well-deserved, and I was really excited about Edge of 17. This writer-director, Kelly Freeman Craig, who I don't know where the hell she came from, but I think it's one of the best teen movies made in a decade. It's really, Hailee Steinfeld is amazing as this sort of depressive, kind of caustic, you know, mean kind of kid, and her best friend starts dating her, Hailee Steinfeld's character's brother, who is this preppy, cute jock, and just totally the kind of antithesis of what she is. So it's kind of about her navigating how to have some sort of idea of herself that she's happy with, but also to not write people off because she thinks that they're one way. I don't know. I would have enjoyed that movie as a teen and really found it helpful.
We did talk about this in a week that Richard wasn't here because I put it in as like a wild wish for screenplay in the Oscar race. But little did I know that Hailee herself would get a Golden Globe nomination for the film. So
yeah, back to the Golden Globes being our favorite out of nowhere. I saw someone say on Twitter, I think that like Hailee Steinfeld broke out in True Grit and then about a decade later decided to come back and prove to us that she could actually act. And I thought that was kind of harsh, but it started to feel like True Grit was a fluke. And then I think Edge of 17 was kind of brought back to be like, oh no, she's incredibly talented.
Well, I think the onus is not entirely on her, and that like people didn't really give her much to do. I mean, the Pitch Perfect 2, you know, that was cute, but
her at Begin Again.
Yeah, she was good in Begin Again.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. She was good in that. Yeah, actually, that movie is secretly kind of great.
Definitely.
So I don't know. I think it's a really exciting performance. I think that Hailee Steinfeld is living a strange sort of life outside of her acting career with like her, you know, pop music stuff.
And
she's gotten in some trouble recently for adopting a certain kind of accent while being interviewed on red carpets at award shows and
stuff. Wait, what? I didn't hear about this.
Yeah, people are sort of saying that she's affecting this kind of, I don't know how to put it delicately, but like sort of urban, you know.
Oh, street.
Street parlance.
Yeah, that is not quite fitting of her demographic, but
this is very in the limelimight digression we're having
here. Yeah, sorry. Save it for Josh and Julie. But anyway, it's a great performance and well worth seeing. And the movie, unfortunately, you know, there were hopes that it would be this sort of like underdog sleeper hit. It really has not done well at the box office, but it's been on a lot of critics' lists, including mine. It won the New York Film Critics Circle Award. It has a Golden Globe nomination. So I think that just given the realities of how people watch movies and how younger people watch movies, I think when this movie is on Netflix, it's going to eat the world.
It's going to be huge. It's going to be one of those movies that 10 years, everyone's like, wait, what? People didn't go see this?
Well, exactly.
Yeah. Well, it's like, yeah, that's what happened with Pitch Perfect, right? So we're going to get, what, Edge of 18? once this becomes right, and a cult hit.
Exactly. Oh, God.
Moving on to number 7, which I...
It's Mike Hogan's favorite movie.
Yeah, Mike Hogan's favorite
Jackie.
Movie. what's interesting about Jackie is it felt like we were going to be talking about it forever in Best Picture context, and it's Oscars, its awards chances really seem to be boiling down to Natalie Portman, which I wonder
why that is.
Oh, yeah. Well, Richard, make the case for Jackie.
Well, I will say Joe Reed, a friend of the podcast, tweeted out, I think the morning that the Golden Globe nominations came out, he said something along the lines of, amazing how when a front runner for Best Actress emerges, all that movie's other chances kind of seem to disappear. Mm-hmm. And I think that that's true. And Joe has written about the fact that it's been not since Million Dollar Baby that a movie that won Best Actress also won Best Picture.
Yeah.
You know, it's just this kind of notoriously bad divide between films with, you know, lauded actress performances and, you know, the general film being honored. I think Jackie at one point looked to have a chance because I think it's a great... the movie is understandably polarizing. It's a weird art film. It's not the kind of biopic that you're maybe expecting. It's got this strange score by Michael Levy. We talked about it last week, I think. It's non kind of linear narratively. Natalie Portman's performance is insane. I mean, it's really a crazy performance, but it works, I think, in this particularly weird movie. I think that if, you know, Ron Howard had directed a Jackie thing and then she did that performance, everyone would be like, she maybe has mental problems, but but like it works. I think it worked. I think everything, you know, it's a fine line between the movie tilting into complete campy disaster. Mm-hmm. And I think to my mind, it stays on the good side of that. But I know that others don't agree.
My campy disaster boundary line is a little closer. Are in than yours, I think.
Yeah.
I meant to see it last night. I haven't seen it yet. I just keep watching the trailers, and like every time Natalie Portman says Camelot, I'm just what am I in for?
No, that voice is really, it kind of like haunts you in this weird way.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, but Jackie Kennedy was a weird person. Like, you watch the footage of that tour of the White House she did, which figured into an episode of Mad Men, I think, because I've seen that before.
Right, yeah.
It's bizarre. Like, her whole affect is bizarre. I mean, she was 34 when JFK died, which is nuts. She was kind of from this patrician New York society. She didn't ever seem comfortable in this national icon role. And Richard, in your top 10, you pointed out that and the film feels timely because many in this country today grapple with the feeling that something huge has just been irreparably broken, which I didn't think of it that explicitly when I watched it, but I did see this since the election, and it really does have this vibe of like shell shock that I think hit me in a really specific way. Mike, I don't know if you saw it before.
I saw it before the election, so I did not have the benefit of only half expecting and fearing shell shock rather than actually living in it. So I could see that. I could see after Trump wins that this crazy shit show in the White House suddenly feels more relevant. Whereas when I was watching it, I was like, this is just bizarre, totally disembodied from any actual things that matter in the world. It's just this, like, you know, I don't know what the hell this is. But, you know, whatever. I'm clearly not the target audience, I don't think, for this. Maybe demographically or whatever.
Gay men.
I
mean,
yeah, I don't even think this is like, I can see there a lot of, like, my mom, I do not think, would like this movie.
My parents watched it over Thanksgiving. I brought a screener home. Like, I thought it was like the prize trophy that I was bringing home. You know, that was like the best screener. And my parents and my sister watched it and they hated it.
So to me, it was it's the Jobs of 2016 movie where you're like, this should be a really great biopic, and you're sitting there going, what the hell went wrong here?
A movie I loved.
There you go.
There you go.
I will also say, I don't know, this Joe Reed thing, I'm sure he has a lot of data at hand, but like Emma Stone has a very good chance of winning La La Land, and La La Land is still a Best Picture possibility. So I wonder, I'm questioning this theory.
I think that often you'll get women who are like touted for Best Actress in a way that the movie just kind of falls way to the wayside, even if it wasn't necessarily ever talked about.
Still like, Alice, the Iron Lady.
I mean, most movies fall to the wayside, but whatever. Okay.
Yeah.
Fine.
I think it is likely, and I'm doing this based on no data, that you will find a Best Actor, Best Picture matchup versus Best Actress and Best Picture.
Okay. I'm sure that's probably true.
That's so funny. I was just thinking about the irrelevance of Still Alice like 2 days ago. I was just like, that is not a movie we're ever going to talk about. And it's going to be like obscure trivia. What did Julianne Moore win her Oscar for? It's like,
I mean, and that's a movie where Kristen Stewart delivers a monologue from Angels in America. Why have we done we should be talking about this every day.
This is like the last thing Alec Baldwin did before he you know, became famous for playing Trump for the rest of his life. Okay, back to your top 10.
Yeah, number 6 is a movie that we've talked about extensively on the podcast. I don't think we need to rehash Manchester by the Sea. I think we all really like that movie.
I have finally seen it, and it's amazing. I really, I think it would be like when I did my own top 10, it was like number 4 or 5.
A movie that I didn't necessarily think when I saw it at Sundance almost a year ago, I didn't think would really kind of endure in my head. I liked it a lot, but it sort of felt small and sort of, you know, removed from emotion in a way. And it really has stuck. And I've watched it, I think, twice since I saw it the first time. And it just, it gets better every time. So
at the risk of underscoring this demographic bias possibility for me, I think this might be my number one of the year.
Yeah.
It's so incredibly moving. I've watched it twice. It's so well constructed. I feel like you're in the hand of a master with Ken Lonergan, who's taken some crazy chances and big swings. And sometimes they work really well and sometimes they haven't in the past. But this one, I just found it incredibly devastating, whatever else is going on around it with the issues surrounding it.
That was another one where when I saw it in the theaters for the second time this last week, the woman next to me had ended and she goes, "What? That's it?"
Who is this woman you're seeing movies with?
I don't know, but she's the best.
What does she want to have happen?
Yeah, I was about understand. To say, Manchester doesn't really like cut off mid-beat. Like it gives you catharsis.
Well, I think a lot of people are hoping that like Casey Affleck's character will be entirely redeemed and have like, work through his shit. And the story is that he can't beat it.
Like,
you know?
What planet do these people live on? That's what I mean, have they ever met a human?
Maybe during Oscar season or whatever. I don't know about that Lobster audience, but like, because I had 5 people walk out of one of my screenings of The Lobster. But like, you know, maybe during Oscar season, people who usually watch more sort of predictable films come to see the movies that have the buzz. And they're like, well, this is not the storytelling I'm quite used to. You know,
you're absolutely right. Thank you for bringing that up. Thank you. Yes, you're right.
And Mike, the self-deprecating thing you said demographically aside, I think if you have a problem with movies about white guys and, you know, sad, mopey white people stories, I don't think Manchester by the Sea is the target for something like this. The story is so well told.
I've seen people whining about it on Twitter.
We need more.
There are a lot of sad white people. Have they ever met, you know?
Well, I mean what is Oscar season if not sad white people?
Right. Yeah,
but I just, you know, there are worse.
Sometimes it's angry white people, Katie.
Or dancing white
Come
people.
On.
Or sad white first ladies.
Yes.
You know?
Right. Oh, God, so many of those. Or iron ladies. There's a lot to choose from, but Manchester by the Sea, I think, deserves your attention, even if you're sick of white people.
It does.
But speaking of more representative movies, Richard, your number 5 gets
American
there.
American Honey. Yeah, an Andrea Arnold film. It's her first film not set in the UK. And a lot of people have criticized this movie. It's this almost 3-hour road trip, bizarre sort of fever dream of a movie. And a lot of people have criticized Andrea Arnold for doing a little bit of like sort of, I don't know, beautifying American poverty or sort of mythologizing it and not really understanding the kind of like how this country works. And I can see that criticism that it's a little bit of like poverty tourism, this Brit indie filmmaker to come into America and try to say something about it. But
it's like the Joshua Tree album of movies.
Exactly. Yes, exactly. But I don't know. I can see that argument, but I think that the movie, which is, you know, sort of devoid of plot, really. It's just these kids driving around in a van, selling magazine subscriptions door to door, getting drunk, getting high at night, having sex. But it's so beautifully filmed. And it really, I think gets at something that, you know, if you look past certain, you know, kind of thinking or closely held beliefs that got Trump elected or whatever, American Honey illustrates a sort of desperation and sort of a kind of recklessness of people who are sort of economically on the fringes of this country, young people especially, who feel just kind of lost. And I think that in setting that kind of feeling to like a road movie where everyone's rootless and just forever moving around the country, I think it kind of captures that feeling of like, well, what do we do now? Really, mm-hmm. really beautifully. And mm-hmm. doesn't come down on one side sort of like in terms of a solution for these people, but it asks a question really interestingly. So, and Sasha Lane, who is this kind of discovery, I think Andrea Arnold saw her on a beach in Florida
yeah.
and was like, do you want to do
the best? That's the best.
I feel like it was even in South America. It was spring break, definitely.
It was somewhere. Yeah. And so she's a great find. Shia LaBeouf, you know, coming back from out of the wilderness with, I think, a really great, intense and weird performance. And I think maybe the standout of the film, there are a lot of non-professional actors, so-called in the movie. But one of the pros is Riley Keough, who had a great year in The Girlfriend Experience.
Elvis's
year.
Granddaughter.
Well, yes, she is Elvis's granddaughter.
Love her.
She's so good in the movie. And she plays the kind of like leader of this group. She's kind of like the den mother. Like they all, you know, they kick up to her when they get these subscriptions. They give her some cut of it. You know, she's just great. And she really brings to mind, I think, like a young Mary Louise Parker in this really fun way. So if nothing else, see that movie for her.
You know, this is a movie that I would have seen by now if it were an hour and 45 minutes. It's sitting on my, like, on top of my DVD player, and I just go, am I going to do the 2.5 hours of Shia LaBeouf road movie now?
That's
I'm not.
Well, you have a really good excuse for not seeing it at Cannes, because it's screened at the same time as our party at the Hotel Cap.
Well, I was going to ask about the magazine subscriptions. Is this how Vanity Fair has been getting that subscription?
Well, that's what I do on weekends. I go in a van with a bunch of hot millennials and just
get people to subscribe to Vanity Fair.
That'd be a good subscription native ad video.
Do you have a clip on Rat Tail so you can go like full Shia LaBeouf?
I do, and I also have Riley Keough's Confederate flag bikini. So
perfect.
I mean, they really are perfect to play two gypsies, like who really is one, and then Riley, who's like from the white trash royalty of America.
Grew up on peanut butter and banana or whatever.
You know, I had been thinking about Andrea Arnold for Fish Tank, which is her kind of breakthrough film that is amazing with Michael Fassbender in it. But I had totally forgotten about her Wuthering Heights until this moment, which I didn't love, but had this great youthful rage in it. You know, that's kind of what the story is. So, yeah, she's so good at that kids on the brink storytelling.
Yeah, she can tap into something, and her movies feel like what the characters are feeling. And that's kind of a trite thing to say, but like, she just kind of embodies that emotion really well.
All right. So let's move on to number four. Our friend Isabelle Huppert.
Yeah.
One of her two movies this year, but you chose Things to Come, not Elle.
I did. I think, you know, Mia Hansen-Love, who wrote and directed Things to Come, I loved the movie she made last year, Eden. She did Goodbye First Love a couple years ago that was so great. She's just one of my favorite filmmakers working right now. And this movie is the softer Huppert performance of the year, certainly compared to this sort of icy power woman she plays in Elle. But, you know, it's still classic Huppert. It's a movie that's about, you know, academics and aging and womanhood and all this. You know, it's a big movie, but it's also small. It's not heavy on plot, but I really liked it.
There's a cat in the still. Is this a notable screen
cat?
Oh,
yeah. So if you go back and listen to the interview I did with Huppert for the podcast, I asked her about the cat. And then she reminded me that there are cats in both Elle and Things to Come. Mm-hmm. She had a really good cat year. The cat in Elle is sort of this like watchful, kind of almost sinister presence.
But sort of witness to a lot of hairy stuff.
Well, the movie opens on a shot of the cat.
Right, yes.
You hear these horrible sounds and the cat is there. But in Things to Come, the cat is more sort of comfort and nuisance, but kind of lovable nuisance. But yeah, great, great cat.
I would throw in Elle as one of the best movies of the year, too. I think it was really good. I mean, it's crazy, but she's insanely good.
Oh, yeah.
Katie, I look forward to your article, Notable Screen Cats of Our Time.
Oh, my God. Well, I was just thinking how really since Inside Llewyn Davis, it feels like we haven't had a screen cat. But this is a slight digression, but I finally saw Patterson, which has an amazing dog.
Great dog.
Yes.
Yeah, like one of the best visual gags of the year belongs to this dog. So.
Oh, yeah. When I saw that at Cannes, the gag you're talking about, I mean, the place like erupted.
Well, because like nothing happens
right,
in that movie.
Finally, there's this thing.
Okay. Number three. Oh, this. Yeah. So this is the documentary that Richard, I feel like you kind of picked up off the screener pile, just kind of nonchalantly and fell in love with.
Yeah. Fire at Sea.
Yeah.
Italian documentary about the refugee crisis on the island of Lampedusa in the Mediterranean, which is an Italian island that's pretty close to the coast of North Africa. It's really the stopping point for a lot of people fleeing war in North Africa and in the Middle East. And it's this really beautiful kind of collage, like almost like it's a moving photo gallery of lives of local Lampedusans and then refugees. It's just beautiful.
Yeah, it's really satisfying. I managed to watch part of it before my DVD player froze and broke the DVD, which is not a problem most people will have. But to see something about something as topical as the refugee crisis in headlines, and there's a lot of like, you know, head shaking you could do, but it's just this very like lived in, just kind of like watching what's happening and seeing. And then that's what's happening. Like there are migrants who are fighting for their lives, and then there's kids who are just kind of watching all this happen on the fringes of their life. And there's so many different ways to experience something so massive.
Yeah, you know, there are no like talking heads in this movie. It's very impressionistic. You know, it's funny, my mom, I told her to watch it and she did. And she said, I just thought that little kid was such a good actor. And I was like, Ma, it's not. It's a documentary. He's real. But because the movie doesn't present itself as this kind of, you know, you must learn this lesson kind of documentary. But it is. It really, I think,
and
highlights.
And then when the credits roll, she's like, what?
Yeah, right.
So Joanna's been seeing movies with your mom.
Right, exactly.
I have been seeing movies with Richard's mom. I didn't want to say it out loud.
But... Well, it had to come
out
eventually.
Good way to get screeners. She's obviously on the screener circuit.
Okay, so Richard, for your number two, you said, what is there to say about Barry Jenkins' luminous poem of a film that hasn't already been said? And I feel like we have talked a lot about Moonlight, and there is getting to be this feeling of like everything there is to say has been said. But let's talk more about Moonlight. This movie's great.
Moonlight's great. Moonlight is one of the most exciting movies to come out in a long time. It's number two for me because I think, you know, it's told in three parts. I think the second part has some problems. But as a whole, I think it it's just such a extraordinary piece of work. And he's a second time director, Barry Jenkins, but you know, it's his first movie in 8 years. And so for a lot of people, it's a debut. I mean, they, you know, people were not really that familiar with Medicine for Melancholy. And what a, you know, thing. I saw it at Telluride. You guys were kind enough to send me there this year. And it was so exciting because, you know, he used to work at the festival. So to be one of the first, really the first public audience to see it, that movie had momentum from then and still has it now. I'm hoping that it will have a good awards run, but we'll see.
I think it will.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, this is one of those years where the movies that the critics are loving, like Manchester by the Sea and Moonlight, both are hanging in there, which is really, and La La Land as well. Usually you get your heart broken at some point around now where it's like, oh, well, we're always going to give it to the artist
actually,
instead.
Actually, Hacksaw Ridge.
Well, yeah, it's not too late, honestly.
It's not.
I'm actually feeling more optimistic about Moonlight than I was, I don't know, when I first saw it in terms of its chances. And, you know, what's there left to say about Moonlight that we haven't said before? I will say that it gets better every single time that I watch it. Like, you would think I would be sort of immune to it by now, but I'm not.
How many times have you seen it?
I think four times.
Wow.
Yeah. This is my number one movie of the year. You know, I usually prefer to pick something that not everyone loves so much, but I just can't help it. Moonlight is just that good. So,
and I'm just thinking about how thrilling it would be a month or so after the inauguration if a movie about a gay black guy won Best Picture. Wouldn't that be great?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Already on Twitter, I posted this Best New TV Characters of 2016 list on Vanity Fair yesterday, and some person accused me of making the white men intentionally the minority, which is not quite how I do lists. But he was, by the way. He was sort of railing about, you know, well, I don't see why we have to endure Moonlight winning Best Picture just because Trump won the election. And I think that's going to be the narrative, that if it wins, some people will try to undercut that win by saying it is just a reaction to the Trump presidency. But God, this movie is just so good on every level for me that I just would feel so good about a Best Picture win here. Just honestly good about the quality of the film. And then, yes, it would feel like a nice middle finger to a certain sex.
Well, if you
America.
Feel like you're enduring Moonlight winning Best Picture, you just have larger problems. Like, it is a great movie regardless of Trump or who's in it or anything else.
I think most likely is Mahershala Ali, right? Winning
Best
Supporting Actor. I mean, that seems quite likely at this point.
That feels anointed, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Although I keep beating this drum, but I feel like Andre Holland is getting unfairly overlooked
so
as we rush to anoint Mahershala Ali. Yeah, I mean, they're both great. Yeah. I would nominate them both.
I voted for Andre Holland first.
I just heard the other day that Naomi Harris only did 2 days of work on Moonlight.
What?
And that's just
wow.
She had like some weird scheduling thing, so she flew from London to Florida for 2 days, shot all of her stuff, and then
during the Spectre press junket or something like that. That's the story I heard. So that's insane.
So it's a movie that like was made in kind of a scrappy, you know, like let's do it when we can kind of way, but it doesn't show any of that. It's so elegant and so purposeful. Everything feels very planned. It's amazing what he did.
Yeah.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.
All right, Richard, you're number one, which I love because I don't think it's on any other critic's number one. But you know, you've been talking about this movie so much that I think I at least saw it coming. The Meddler.
The Meddler, another movie I saw in 2015 for the
first
time.
There you go.
But it came out this past spring. I mean, you know, look, on a sort of formal level, is The Meddler better than Moonlight? I mean, no. But that movie, it's just stuck with me for so long. And despite what you think about her political posturing, Susan Sarandon, I think, gave the performance of the year in this movie.
And she's, you have so no good, like, the Bernie bro-ness of it doesn't bother you when you look back at The Meddler now.
I mean, I would like to think that I can separate, you know, art from artist in some ways. You know, well, in this case, anyway. I just think she's so good. Like, she you know, she plays this meddling mother. You know, she's recently widowed, moves from New Jersey to L.A. to live near her daughter, who's a TV writer. So it's autobiographical. Laureen Scafaria wrote and directed it. She made that movie, Seeking a Friend for the End of the World, a mm-hmm. few years ago. And this is a big leap up, I think, from that movie. And yeah, Sarandon just like gets every little nuance and detail of that kind of nattering, you know, sort of mom. And, you know, a lot of the movie is her leaving voicemails for her daughter. And, you know, I'm talking about my mom a lot on this podcast, but like it sort of felt familiar, you know. And the movie, I think, is quietly and sort of secretly a really interesting look at how people kind of grieve in the everyday of things and just, you know, try to live upbeat lives, but are still sort of mired in a sadness for someone that they miss. And it's just got great performances from Sarandon, from Rose Byrne, from J.K. Simmons. You know, it's a great, really lived in, nice, fun movie. And I think that, you know, it's okay that it's upbeat and it's okay that it isn't annihilatingly sad. It shows a version of something that I think I'd like to be reminded of, that things are sometimes okay.
I think you and I often share an affection for movies that are just really affectionate, that like really yeah. are warm toward their characters and want them to succeed and yeah. not doing it in a cloying way or in like a, you know, trying to hide all their faults kind of way, but just, you know, having a generous heart. I think J.K. Simmons' character kind of embodies a lot of that, where he's this cop who's just like, yeah, I'm just going to be, it's going to be a good, nice guy. And maybe after Whiplash, it's nice for us all to.
Yeah, he raises chickens.
Yeah. Nice. And yeah. he plays Dolly Parton for them.
That's right.
What a great life those chickens have.
All right, I know.
What I love about this movie is it shows it's in a women's world, but, you know, it's a totally recognized. It's not like some of these crazy fantasy movies for men or for women where it's like all the men are characters. All the men are like fabulous, rounded people in this, but you are fully in the women's perspective. Mm-hmm. And I think you're absolutely right. It takes on heavy topics without heaviness. And Susan Sarandon, I would love to see her get nominated for this. I think let's start the thing.
Yeah.
I think she should be nominated. There was one quibble I have mm-hmm. with her Brooklyn accent. Is she hits the R's. She pronounces the R's.
Oh, that's interesting.
I wonder about that. Unless there's some part of Brooklyn
where that's happening. Where that, some little corner of Bensonhurst.
The performance is so precise, but it's funny. As someone whose family came from Brooklyn, I was like, what's going on with these R's over here?
Yeah. Well, Susan's best friend Bernie Sanders might be able to help her with her Brooklyn
accent.
Yeah,
Bernie can teach her.
That's right. You know, we're talking about it, the film's awards chances or her award chances. I think it's far enough in the past now that I can say, like, when I was voting for New York Film Critics Circle, you know, we do rounds of voting for, so and I kept voting for her for Best Actress. And at some point, I think someone said, like, who keeps voting for The Meddler? And I it was my first year doing it, so I sort of just like sank in my chair. But I just had to. I mean, it's
now
just
they
so,
know.
Yeah, it's just so good.
You were the meddler in that circumstance.
I knew who Pear was going to win, so
I mean,
throwing my vote away.
So, you know, the rest of us didn't publish official. Well, Joanna, did you do an official TV top 10, or are you doing characters? Or
Rich and I did a best new TV shows of 2016 list.
Yeah. So would one of your choices on that be your choice for the best TV show of 2016?
Yeah, I would say so. I'm torn between something at the top of the year and something I just watched, which is People versus OJ. It's hard to argue that that's not the best new TV show of 2016, just by virtue of what everyone was talking about and quality and awards garlands and all of that. But I have to say, and I know Katie just started watching it, so she'll be on my team. And here's an insider tip. Richard wanted to cut it from the list, is that The Crown on Netflix, not that he hated it, just he was like, I think we ended up with 11, and he was like, we could lose The Crown. I was like, nope, The Crown.
No.
It's so anti-VF of me.
I know.
Are you out of your mind?
The Crown is a show that I like immediately started watching again once I finished. I loved it. If you want to talk about unrelatable white people problems, that's probably what The Crown is. But I just think it's exquisitely directed, written. The production value is incredible. The performances are amazing. It taught me a lot about history that I thought I didn't give a crap about. And it turns out I do. Like, I'm one of the few Vanity Fair writers who doesn't breathlessly follow the royals. And now I'm like, oh, I get it. I'm here. I'm here for it. You won me over. So Yeah, and I would say I think Jared Harris on The Crown is my performance of the year. A white man, I will say. Take that, list doubters.
Haters.
And, yeah. So
must we endure? Yeah.
So yeah, that would be my vote probably. It's a toss up. It's hard, but because People vs. O.J. also tapped into so much of what we're currently dealing with in terms of, you know, villainizing women and divided racial issues in this country. Like, it so perfectly put his finger on that pulse. So it's hard to argue that it's not the best, but, you know, my heart votes for The Crown.
And it seems to have been a big hit.
Yeah.
My review of The Crown did really well. Like, a lot of people read it. So people are like into this thing.
And I think people are doing a lot of Googling. Like, I was watching last night and I was like, Googled like Princess Margaret affair or something like that, and our story on Princess Margaret was the top Google hit.
Perfect.
So you can like we're getting people in from this little behind the curtain action
us,
for
yes.
you.
Yeah.
But yeah, if anyone's gonna write obsessively about The Crown, it's definitely us. I watched two episodes and I'm so into it. I'm avoiding my screeners of American Honey as a result, so I'm right there with you, Mike.
I recorded an episode of In the Limelight with Josh and Julie, our coworkers, that is also going to be dropping this week, or maybe just already did, but we were talking about Meghan Markle and Prince Harry, and I was like, oh god, that season is going to be amazing.
I
when
know.
This American actress like shows
oh my
up
God.
Like I'm going to be a few years away, obviously, but yeah, I mean, there's so much that The Crown did in its first season that's great, even though I wanted to cut it from the list, but but what's coming is also going to be so exciting.
The Diana stuff, I mean, forget it.
Oh yeah, no, it made me want to rewatch The Queen in the meantime and kind of relive all that Diana stuff. You did,
I did watch The Queen. I watched, well, I hadn't seen it, so I watched it for the first time, and yeah, it's incredible. And just it's Peter Morgan, right? What Peter Morgan has done in terms of like devoting his life to understanding Queen Elizabeth, because he also wrote The Audience, which is the play about Queen Elizabeth and her many prime ministers. So the fact that he's just like, you know what? I'm all in on this one fascinating lady.
He's single-handedly making her seem interesting.
He's like Robert Caro with LBJ.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
She's just got this fixation.
Well, and you know, she's been the queen for over 60 years.
Well, so can we go back to movies for a second?
Yeah.
Because there's a couple things we got to talk about with Richard's list.
Okay.
One is that La La Land is not on it.
Nope.
The movie that a lot of people think is going to win Best Picture, that Richard is quoted on the fucking posters for.
Yeah. It's everywhere.
So
I mean, I honestly have gotten so many texts and like Facebook messages like, I saw your name, and it's great. It's really fun. But, you know, it's just funny.
So answer for yourself, Richard.
La La Land, I saw at Telluride. I loved it. You know, kind of fired off a effusive review, though criticizing the middle stretch of the movie where it's like there's not many songs. It's just sort of a relationship drama. And that movie has increasingly not sat well with me. I still think it's a feat of filmmaking and it's really, you know, it's great, but it's cooled in my kind of memory. I need to watch it again, I think.
10 is hard sometimes.
Yeah, I mean, like, there were movies that I wrestled with. I mean, I think the one that sticks out in my mind as like it was 11 maybe was Pete's Dragon. I love that movie.
Oh,
that movie was
that
kind
movie.
Of overlooked.
Real quick, off the top of our heads, as if you're listening to this and you want to go out to the theaters and go see something in the movie theater, what should everyone actually be checking out to see over this break? I'm going to say La La Land because I think it's finally open wide and everyone ought to see it, even if I'm a grump about it.
If it's playing in your city, I say go see Hidden Figures. It's a nice, uplifting, great story that is a true story that has not been told. I think it's more opening wide more later in January, but I think it will be playing in some cities now.
That is a great mom movie. I don't know, but
it's a great,
your mom is more adventurous
everybody
than a lot
movie.
Of moms.
Yeah, it's just, I'm glad that it's getting the kind of awards love that it's been getting so far, because I think it deserves it.
I think Arrival, if we're talking about movies that haven't been brought up yet, Arrival's a good one.
Yeah, I love Arrival.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, really nice performance, another great performance by Amy Adams.
Yeah.
I will throw support either behind Lion if it's still playing, or
Lion's
Miss Sloan.
Good.
Yeah.
Or Miss Sloan if it's still playing near you. That's something that we're not talking a lot about, but I quite liked it. So
Miss Sloan is fun. It's like got that, you know, it's got twists and it's good.
Oh, see, I didn't know it was fun. That's actually I kind of thought it was this very like straightforward drama about gun control.
No, I mean, Joanna, right? It's kind of a thriller. I mean, how I saw it anyway. Yeah.
Yeah, and a great Chastain performance. And what holiday is complete without a great Chastain performance? So
yeah, and she has some good scenes with a sort of sexy Jake Lacy, which is, you know, and he was, you know. Kind of in Carol last year, more buttoned up. So he's,
I thought he was just going to be the like very nice boyfriend.
No,
sexy
not
boyfriend.
And this one is a little different. Yep.
Exciting. Well, that does it for this week's episode and for the year. Thank you, everybody, for listening to us thus far. 2017 is going to really start with a bang. We're going to have the Golden Globes really before we know it. In the meantime, you can find us all at vanityfair.com, even though it's a little quiet for the break. We're all on Twitter at Little Gold Men, and on our own, I'm at Katie Rich. Richard?
Rylaws, R-I-L-A-W-S.
Joanna?
Joe Rothen.
And Mike?
Mike underscore Hogan.
This episode was edited and produced by Alana Milner, and thanks to Laura Mayer and Andy Bowers at Panoply. This week's award for most exciting holiday plans goes to Richard Lawson.
I go in a van with a bunch of hot millennials.
Hi, I'm Lale Arakoglu, host of Women Who Travel. Each story from our guests and listeners is totally unique and utterly personal. We love hearing about your first impressions when visiting someplace new.
My first trip to the Patagonia region was on the Argentine side. I couldn't believe the expansive territory. It's like being in Tibet. The emptiness and the harshness really, I found transformative.
Or a story told when safely back on dry land.
You know, things happened every single day. I ran out of gas on a jet ski in the middle of the ocean. And I was like, what if a sea creature comes to eat me? But then I'm delusional. I was like, I'll make friends with it and it won't eat me. And maybe I'll ride that back to shore.
That's how it works.
Yeah.
Join me, Lale Arakoglu, every week for more adventures on Women Who Travel, wherever you listen to your podcasts.